MacCast, Tuesday, June 19th, 2018. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's Tom for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. How are you doing? Hope you're having a great week so far. We've kicked things off. That's going all right for me, hanging in there. Looking over the show notes, we have just a ton of things to talk about, a lot of things to get into this week. Probably one of the bigger sections is going to be all this stuff on entertainment news, but we're going to get to a little bit of international news this week, talk a little bit about iWork, Apple and USB lockouts on iPhones. We'll explain what all that means. Also, just USB stuff in general related to the iPhone, got some news there, and then Apple tightening up some rules surrounding the App Store and what your apps can do with your contact record. So we're going to get into all of those stories and information, and then we're also going to get to some of your feedback. I have some follow-up for you. We're going to talk about your comments or some of your thoughts on subscription applications, something that I talked about on the last episode of the MacCast. We're going to get a little more into the state of gaming on the Mac, and then try and help a listener out with a little iCal issue. So we're going to try and help someone out this week, like we do here on the MacCast. So it should be a great show. We're going to get into that in just a moment. But before we do, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Small Dog Electronics. You know, Small Dog, if you're looking for Apple Mac accessories, if you're looking for a new notebook, you're looking for a Mac, they are a great place to check out. They are a part of the Mac community. They've been around helping give Apple fans deals and great service for literally decades. They started out of a garage, but now you can get awesome deals every day on their website. And you want to make sure you check out the website frequently because they are constantly updating it, either their website or they also have a great Facebook page, Facebook group that you can check out. You'll find the link for that on their website as well because they're always adding new stuff. They've got really great deals. A great place to start when you're heading to the website is the deal of the day. Right now, for example, they have a 27-inch 5K iMac, a custom built-to-order machine, 4.2 gigahertz, 8 gigabytes of RAM, 3 terabyte Fusion drive, and it's $200 off just because it has a dented carton. Nothing wrong with the machine, just has a box that has a little dent in it, and you can get a great deal because of that. It's a brand new machine ready for your desk, so you can check that out right now. You're also going to want to look in their refurbished and clearance section. They have a lot of great deals there, and of course, they have tons of really great new stuff. They have HomePods in stock and ready to go. You know I'm a fan of the HomePod, and you would not be disappointed as an Apple fan picking up a new HomePod, and you can get one from Small Dog. They're ready to go, ready to ship out right now in stock. And it's not just Apple gear. They have other great accessories, cables, more, just everything you're going to need for your Mac. They have a great selection. As a matter of fact, I was looking at this because summer started. Great selection of rugged outdoor Bluetooth speakers ready for your camping trip or your pool party, whatever you might need. And I really encourage you to check them out. Support those folks that support us. Like I said, they're a part of our community, and they do a lot to support the show, and I really appreciate them for that. Check out smalldog.com for all your Macintosh and Apple needs, just all your electronics needs, really. And be sure to email them, post their Facebook, send them a tweet, let them know how much you appreciate them supporting the MacCast. I really do, and a big thanks to Small Dog for their support. Let's talk a little bit about USB-C maybe coming to a future iPhone. Actually, you know, I wouldn't hold your breath on this, but DigiTimes thinks that Apple is going to do it over the next year. They've reported that they think that Apple will swap out at some point the Lightning cable, or the Lightning connector, rather, on your iPhone for a USB-C connector. And believe me, I get it. On the surface, it makes a whole lot of sense, right? Apple has thrown in support on their entire Mac lineup for USB-C. even with that, though, I just still don't see it happening with the iPhone. And I have a number of reasons for believing Apple's not going to do it. First and foremost, they have built a very healthy ecosystem around the Lightning connector with a ton of third-party support. And you might argue, and you could say, and I would agree, that Apple's never been one to hold on to a single connector. FireWire is a great example of this. They move to something bigger and better when it makes sense to do so. But that brings me to my other point. USB-C would have to offer something on the iPhone that is significantly better, and besides just making it more open or more compatible. USB-C is a little bit larger, so the Lightning connector already has the advantage of being smaller, and it's just a great connector and something we've had for a long time. And I think most people have all the stuff they need to connect with that. So switching now wouldn't really solve any existing problem, at least not as I see it, and actually would cause a little bit more headache, at least in the short run, with different adapters and dongles. And really, the USB-C to Mac connectivity thing is solved with a simple cable. And according to other rumors, Apple is more likely to include a USB-C to Lightning cable in the box with this year's iPhones. And I do think that is very likely going to happen. I also think they're going to include a USB-C wall charger. So the charger will have a USB-C connector on it. It's reportedly going to be 18 watts, so it'll be a fast charger. You can do fast charging through USB-C to Lightning over the existing Lightning connector. So again, that's one thing being thrown around. Well, you can do fast charging with USB-C. Well, you can do fast charging with Lightning. You can also do faster charging with wireless. And getting to that point, I think it's actually more likely that Apple would dump the Lightning connector altogether before they go to USB-C. I think Apple's pushing really hard to not have any connector on the iPhone whatsoever. I don't think they're going to do it anytime soon. I think there's some challenges to work out, specifically what happens if you have some faults in the iPhone and you want to be able to connect it to a computer. You probably want some sort of diagnostic port or connector. So, you could probably get away doing a lot of things through wireless, and we already know we can do a full recovery over wireless. We can do our backups and restoring over the air, so we're pretty close to being able to handle all that stuff and really not need the Lightning connector. When I think about my own usage of my iPhone, I almost never connect it to my computer. The rare occasion is when I want to do a backup for those few times where I might have to do a complete erase, restore, and restore of my iPhone. And I just like to have an encrypted backup. But more and more, even there, I am restoring my backup from iCloud. Apps are all re-downloading to iOS from the App Store. So I think we're really getting to the point where there might not be any connector on there at all. You're going to do completely over the air. And I think that'll happen long before we get USB-C. But it's an interesting idea, and I think that's why the rumor sort of floats around there. There also have been reports that Apple may be planning to upgrade the charging circuitry in the iPhone to something that's going to move a little bit faster from the 5-volt 2-amp to 9-volt 2-amps and 5-volt 3-amps. I guess it would be dependent upon the model. Probably the plus size model is going to get the 3-amp charging, I would assume. Anyway, this rumor is coming based on some new chips that come from Power Integrations. That's the company that Apple uses for the charging chips, and the updated circuitry would supposedly allow for a much quicker recharging rate, which is always something good, because as you're running out of juice on your iPhone, you want to juice it back up as quickly as possible. And I do think that is something that will be probably happening. Always a good thing to make charging work a little bit quicker on your iPhone. We also have some supply chain rumors that are sort of up to their old tricks again, and as usual, they're sending what I think are mixed signals and messages across the Apple sphere. What I mean by that is we're getting conflicting reports about the distribution and how Apple feels about how this year's iPhones are going to sell. First off, we have the Wall Street Journal saying that Apple is tweaking their production and putting more focus on this year's rumored low-cost LCD iPhone. This is the 6.1-inch model. It's expected to have the same design, the notch, the whole true-depth camera system, no home button. They're expecting Apple to save some costs on the screen with the LCD. Also, it will very likely not have 3D touch and a single-lens camera system and come in at a price point. I think they're expecting it to start around $600 or $700 as the starting price point. So the Wall Street Journal is saying Apple is expecting that to be a huge seller. In fact, they claim that Apple feels consumers will so heavily gravitate to the lower priced option that they will produce as many of that model as they will of the other two rumored OLED models, the iPhone X, or what will be the replacement for the iPhone X at 5.8 inches, and the rumored iPhone X Plus at 6.5 inches. So Apple expected to sell as many of the low-cost models as those two other models combined, at least according to the Wall Street Journal. They also say that they expect Apple to continue to sell the LCD model in their lineup through 2019. There had been some rumors that Apple is trying to go all OLED or might even be looking into micro LED technology for a future iPhone, but we're expecting that to come in a future Apple Watch display first. It's technology that Apple's looking into, but it looks like it's not quite ready to scale up just yet, and it's still even iffy as to when we might see it in an Apple Watch display. So, you know, LCD technology, especially Apple's LCD technology, it in the past has been able to beat some of the OLED displays. You know, again, not all displays are created equal, and Apple makes some really killer, very high standard LCD displays. And I think many consumers are still happy with the LCD technology. So if they can produce that, it costs less, they can get better yields, better profit margins, and consumers are happy with it, I think it totally makes sense for Apple to keep an LCD model in the lineup. There's no real need to move everything to OLED, especially given a lot of the production challenges Apple has had with OLED technology. So I buy into this rumor. Are they going to sell as that many LCD iPhones? I think this year the low-cost iPhone is going to be a hugely popular model. I think there's a lot of people that skipped the iPhone X and even the iPhone 8 cycle this year because of cost and just there wasn't enough new features, but they're getting to that two-year mark and ready to upgrade, and I think Apple is really wanting to have a product lineup that's going to appeal to all levels of consumer. Now, here comes that confusing part, because a seemingly conflicting report from a Korean publication claims that Apple has ordered more screen panels for the 6.5 inch iPhone X Plus than, quote, any other model. They say Apple has ordered 45 million 6.4 inch panels, 25 million 5.8 inch panels, and 30 million 6.04 inch LCD displays. So you notice that 6-inch display is not just a hair over 6 inches, not really 6.1. So that's been another part of this rumor. Is it going to be a 6-inch display or a 6.1? In the Korean report, it looks like they're leaning towards the 6-inch size. But nonetheless, they're predicting that the iPhone X Plus is going to be the big seller in 2019, at least according to what it looks like Apple's ordering from the supply chain. Now, remember, supply chain, not a really good indicator of what Apple is up to. And you also need to keep in mind that the LCDs are readily available from multiple suppliers. With OLED, Apple was really dependent upon one supplier, Samsung. There's a few others that can maybe pick up some of the slack. But if they're only looking at where, you know, orders with one vendor, say Samsung, then that might not be giving the whole picture of the number of LCD panels that Apple is looking to buy. Although, looking at these numbers, 45 million, 30 million, and 25 million, that does look like a typical ramp-up production number that Apple would be looking to produce going into selling new models combined. So the numbers seem to add up, but I have a feeling the LCD panels could be much larger. There have been some rumors that Apple's having some issues with those LCD panels, and it could be a smaller number because of production delays, and they might not be ordering panels till a little bit later. So that may just be an initial supply, and then they will ramp that up pretty quickly. And once again, they can do that because, again, there's more availability quality of LCD panels. So I wouldn't read too much into this. I do think the iPhone X Plus, the plus size, again, I think that is going to be a very popular model, especially with a lot of the updated features. So I expect that the way this will all pan out is Apple will sell a ton of the lower cost 6.1 inch model, followed by the 6.5 inch plus model, and then the updated 5.8 inch model for the iPhone X is going to sell a little bit less, because I think all those people who bought 10s this year may not upgrade, or last year rather, may not upgrade this year. But that's just my thoughts on it. What do you think? Shoot me some email, maccast@gmail.com. If you watched this year's Worldwide Developer Conference keynote, you no doubt caught on to the fact that Apple had a not so subtle message about their focus on security and privacy. They talked about it in almost every session. It's a very important thing for Apple. They want to keep our information secure and private. Something that was discussed on stage, or that was not discussed on stage, but is now being reported by Bloomberg, is that Apple is tightening some of the rules on what apps are allowed to do once you grant them access to your contacts. So, you know, a lot of applications will say, for various reasons, hey, we want to have access to your contacts database or your contact records. Is that okay? Now, typically, this would be like an email application, or it might be another business contact management application. I have some billing applications that I use for my business that want that kind of access. But other applications, it might be a little bit more vague, like a game wanting access to your contacts. Now, that's typically so they can try and match you up with your friends, especially if it's a multiplayer over the internet style game. But another thing that has been going on is that once that access is granted, it's been somewhat of a free-for-all as to what they can do. Basically, they can suck your contact records out, and if you don't read the full privacy policy for the app that you've downloaded, because, yeah, we read those, right? If you haven't read that, they could be doing all kinds of things and sharing that data and information you don't really know, and there haven't been really hard and fast rules about that. It's sort of like ask for permission, and if it's granted, go for it. And what's been happening is some apps, after you say yes, would use your contacts for marketing purposes, and also sometimes even sell or share that information on to third parties. And what Apple has said now is that that can't or shouldn't happen anymore. The big issue is while you gave permission for them to access your contacts, all of your contacts, those people that gave you their information, they didn't really give permission for that data to be shared with anyone. So, you know, it's a messy, kind of tricky situation, and Apple is trying to deal with it. So what's happening now is developers can no longer make databases of address book information, and they are expressly forbidden from sharing or selling that data with third parties. So they can grab it for their own uses, but they're not allowed to collect it, store it, and continue on using it outside of the purposes of the app. They also cannot ask for access for one reason. So they can't tell you, hey, we need this information for one reason, and then later change how they're using that information without re-asking for your permission. And Apple is putting some pretty stiff punishment on this. If they get caught breaking the rules, it's banishment from the App Store. So you are out. I don't think there's any three strike policy. I think it's one strike and you're gone. Now, keep in mind that any data that you might have shared already via an app, it's already out there. They already have access to it. And it doesn't really fall under these rules. This would be for things moving forward from this point forward. And you can double check right now already what apps have permission to your contact records and turn off their access. And if you do it now, that's going to be off for any future access of new contact data. But once again, they likely already have your existing contact data. To do this, go into the settings on your iPhone or iPad under privacy. And I think you do need to do it separately for every device that you own. But go into settings, privacy, contacts, and you can see what applications have access to your contact database. And this just serves, I think, as a good reminder about all of the data and information that any application might ask, including you know, can I send you notifications? Can I access the camera? Can I access the microphone? Can I access, I don't know, what else do they ask for access to? Your contact database. I'm sure there's your calendar. I'm sure there's other things that I'm thinking about. I've taken personally now a default posture to almost all of these requests of just tapping no. Like my habit is no, 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 and then I figure it out later. Because so many of these apps do it right on startup, right? You're bombarded with these things. And I think a lot of other people usually just, oh, forget it, and they just click yes. I would say more and more these days we're going to want to say no. And you can always turn that stuff back on later in privacy if you discover while using the app, oh yeah, it really does need access to this bit of information because I want to use this bit of functionality. Like I want to use the sharing. But if you're using an app and you're never planning on using the sharing, like a game is a great example of this, right? If you're never planning on trying to be matched up with your friends in the game, don't give it access to your contact database. Just don't do it from the very get-go. And I think more and more, you know, with what's been happening in the media lately, the Facebook stuff, Google stuff, all those sorts of things, we need to be a lot more responsible ourselves. It's great that Apple has taken this posture, but I think we need to be a lot more responsible ourselves over our own data and protecting our own data. And Apple's obviously got our backs and they're giving us some great tools. So this was kind of a great thing to the great little story to see this week. And I'm glad they're doing it, but it is going to make it a little bit trickier, more tricky for developers. I guess it just, and that's probably not even the right thing to say. Developers are going to have to be a lot more responsible about what they're doing with our data. And if they don't, you know, Apple is going to punish them for it. Apple, another thing that's been going on related to security and privacy is a new feature in iOS 12. And I think we talked about this, the USB restricted mode. And there was some speculation and some theories that Apple was adding this to deal with some of the cracking devices that are out there now, specifically the ones from Grayshift. And Apple gave a statement to 9to5 Mac this week saying that, yes, the new USB restricted mode is a response to trying to improve the security protections of their products, but no, it is not a direct response to the new tools being used by law enforcement to gain access to locked iPhones like GrayKey. In the statement, an Apple spokesman wrote, "We have the greatest respect for law enforcement, and we don't design our security improvements to frustrate their efforts to do their jobs." You remember USB restricted mode enabled in iOS 12 will disable data access to the Lightning port an hour after the last successful unlock. So you unlock your device once it goes back into a locked state. If you don't unlock it again for an hour, what'll happen is the Lightning port, the data access through the Lightning port then becomes blocked. You can only actually do charging until you successfully unlock the device again. And what a lot of these devices, or the GrayKey device specifically, relies upon is connecting to a computer and then doing a brute force password attempt over the Lightning cable through the data access. So this presumably would lock that down. And Apple says they were working on this security feature actually before they learned about the stuff being used by law enforcement. They say that after learning about how the attack worked, they did review the iPhone operating system and code and altered it to improve security. But once again, they're denying that it's any sort of direct response to this thing. They're just saying, hey, we're trying to make the iPhone more secure. Who you're going to believe? I think you're going to have to make your own choices on that. I think Apple's usually pretty much on the up and up. But, you know, given the timing of this stuff and the whole cat and mouse nature of this whole thing, I'm sure some of it is in response to what's going on. The reason being is it makes sense, because if GrayKey or Grayshift with the GrayKey box is able to figure this out, very good chance that, you know, government agencies, that big, giant criminal organizations that have access to a lot of cash and resources, they can probably figure this stuff out too. You know, they are sophisticated. They employ hackers and very smart people. They have a vested interest in doing things, you know, a ring that is processing stolen iPhones. They would very much like to have this technology, and it will get out there. As a matter of fact, we know the Grayshift technology did leak out. So, you know, Apple needs to be able to lock this stuff down and fight it. And of course, it is a real big cat and mouse issue, because as a matter of fact, Grayshift, the company who makes Grayshift, they claim that they've already been able to work around this new feature and that they've taken several steps to, quote, future-proof their technology. So they're kind of taunting Apple a little bit, saying, hey, you can do whatever you want, but we already know how to get past it. Whether that's true or not, again, it's all he said, she said. We really don't know. But once again, I think Apple's posture on this is really good. And once again, I will say, your best course of action is to take responsibility and control over your own security using the tools that Apple provides. This means don't use a simple 4-digit passcode. Don't even use a 6-digit numeric passcode. Use at least a 6-digit alphanumeric, and I would say you want it to be much, much longer. And then rely on Touch ID or Face ID to get around the inconvenience of having to constantly put in a long passcode. But longer the passcode, the better. Make sure that it's random, that there's not any patterns, that there's not any known words. You know, all those things we know about passwords, you should be doing that on your iPhone lock code. And that will thwart even things like the Grayshift and the Grayshift, because again, they're doing brute force. And the longer it takes them to figure out your password, they're going to just move on. They're going to go to the other device that has the 4-digit passcode that they can get into in a couple minutes. I believe when I first reported this report, if you have a 4-digit passcode, this technology can get in a matter of minutes. If it is a 6-digit numeric passcode, I think it's up to a couple days. Again, it depends on what kind of passcode you're using. But you make it longer than that, and it starts to get into the years, you know, months and years for them to be able to unlock your device. And by that point, it may be a moot point, right? You maybe could have remotely wiped it at that point, whatever it might be. So, you know, if you're really concerned about this stuff, that's what I would do. The other thing related to this, and I kind of had my eyes opened up on us taking more responsibility, and also just developers. I'm a web developer. I went to a WordPress conference recently. We've had GDPR talks, which have been going on. And if you don't know what GDPR is, those are the new regulations in the EU concerning people's rights to control the privacy of their data. They can now request that data be removed from services like Facebook and Google, or any service rather. You also have to be more notified transparently, not just through, you know, some weird privacy policy on a website about why a site is asking for data and what they're doing with that data. So I went to a bunch of talks to figure this all out, because it's kind of a hassle, frankly, as a web developer to kind of have to deal with these regulations. But what I came away understanding was more of the idea behind this. And one of the guys that I heard talk had a great philosophy on this. He said, what this is forcing us all to do is to think a lot more, both developers and also us as users, people who give our information somewhat freely for a lot of us to these services now. It is a moment in time for us to all pause, take a step back, and be a lot more careful and less callous with our information. And that includes asking for information. The people who collect information being a lot less callous about just gathering everything that we can. We kind of took this posture of, well, let's just ask for it. And if they give it to us, great. We don't know why we want it, but let's just get all the information from people that we have. We can stick it in our database. And if we ever need it, guess what? We have it. But we don't know what we're going to use it for. And what this forces everybody to do is start to question, okay, what bits of information do I really need for this service or this thing that I'm trying to provide? What do I need to gather for it to actually work? And anything outside of that, we shouldn't share. We shouldn't ask for. Both parties should be consistently asking, why is this information needed? And if it's not absolutely needed for the thing that we're trying to do, hey, just let's not collect it, or let's not provide it in, you know, because of a just because. Why do you need it? Well, just because we'd like to have it. Oh, sure, here you go. No, we're not going to do that anymore. And that's what a lot of this stuff is sort of about. So, you know, let's all take a little bit more control over our own security and privacy. And I encourage you to talk with your less technical, your less nerdy friends about all of this stuff. I think it's a generally good idea to do this. And the more we spread this information and this idea that, you know, our privacy really is important, and it's something we do really need to protect, I think the better. All right, now we get into probably the biggest section of the show this week. And I kind of feel like this is turning into some sort of entertainment news show, but this is a big thing that's going on with Apple. They are vastly expanding their efforts in original TV content and programming with their worldwide video division. We heard this week of them picking up some new players, some new people to add to their staff, heavy hitters. Kelly Costello, who is a former Broadway Video and Viacom executive, has reportedly joined Apple as a business affairs executive. While at Broadway Video, she oversaw legal affairs, did business deals and agreements for popular series like Portlandia and Documentary Now. It seems like she's going to be doing similar kinds of duties at Apple under Philip Mathis, who was hired as Apple's head of business affairs for worldwide video back in December. Apple is also ordering up a number of new shows. We're going to kind of get into a bunch of them here. Apple has ordered a 10-episode series based on Hildy Lisiak. And if you don't know who that is a 10-year-old journalist who publishes a paper in her hometown of Selins Grove, Pennsylvania, called the Orange Street Press. And she kind of got a little bit of internet fame a while back when she broke a story in her hometown about a murder, I think at the age of 9. It garnered her a lot of national and international media attention, and this series is going to be partially based on that story. The series Apple ordered will follow a young girl who moves from Brooklyn to a small lakeside town her father is from, and while there, she unearths a cold case that everybody in town, including her father, is trying to bury. They're trying to keep under wraps, and that's kind of the premise of this story. So Apple's picked that up. They've ordered a 10-episode season of that, and so that'll be another thing in their lineup once they release that. And we still kind of don't know, and we'll talk about that in a little bit, exactly how they're going to do this. But there's some speculation out now on the couple of ways that Apple might do it. And I'm curious to get your opinions on that. But before we get to that, a couple other bits of content Apple is picking up. Bloomberg reports that Apple is possibly getting close to doing a deal for a new animated movie with the company Cartoon Saloon. You may recognize that name. Cartoon Saloon is an award-winning Irish-based animation studio known for their very distinctive style. They also have a number of Academy Award nominated films, The Secret of Kells, Song of the Sea, and The Breadwinner. All of these are really great animated films. If you haven't caught any of them, I would encourage you to check them all out. I think a lot of them are available on Netflix or Amazon right now. And they also created the Emmy-nominated preschool series Puffin Rock, which is on Netflix. If you have little kids, you may have run across Puffin Rock. It's really cool stuff. And it looks like Apple is looking to get the distribution rights in the United States and a few other countries for their newest movie. We don't really know what it's about. I believe it looks like it's titled Wolf Walkers. To me, that sounds like it might be kind of a werewolf movie, but I don't know. They usually base a lot of their stories on Celtic or Irish sort of, or a few of them, I guess, have been based on that folklore. And so maybe it's in that vein, and maybe someone from that region in our audience might know a little bit more about what wolf walkers are. Or it could just be totally unrelated. I really have no idea, but I'm curious. So if you know, let us know. It's not clear how Apple plans to handle distribution of the film. This would actually be the first film that we're hearing about Apple getting involved in. It does seem like they would at least want to release it in some form into theaters, so it could be considered for the awards shows. This deal is not finalized at this point. It's just preliminary talks. So we don't know if this is something Apple will get, but again, if they do, it's going to be their first movie. The worldwide video team has been mostly focused on TV shows, specials, documentaries, that sort of thing. Series, really, and it's expected for some sort of subscription service. Apple is also getting a show from Oprah Winfrey, it looks like, in an official announcement. One of the first ones we've seen on this. All of this other stuff related to series that Apple's been ordering, that's all been speculation and rumor, sort of stuff coming out of the different, you know, magazines like, or the different publications like Variety and those sorts of places. This week we got an actual official announcement from Apple saying that they have signed a unique multi-year content partnership with Oprah Winfrey, excuse me. In one of the shortest press releases I think I've ever seen from Apple, it was just a few lines, not a lot of details. They say they will work with Winfrey to, quote, create original programs that embrace her incomparable ability to connect with audiences around the world. So I don't know if that means she's going to be doing a talk show series or if it's going to be, you know, content based on books, or we don't really know at this point. They also state that the projects will be released as part of a lineup of original content from Apple. I don't think that this confirms that they're actually doing, like, this isn't Apple saying, yeah, we're going to do a TV subscription service. They've kind of danced around this, but they haven't really officially come out and said, yep, that's something we're doing. We do know they have a couple of original content shows they've released through Apple Music. Depending upon your feelings about them, you may think they're good or not. Planet of the Apps, of course, and Carpool Karaoke. They're actually doing a second season of Carpool Karaoke. So it could just be part of that they're talking about as a lineup of, quote, original content, or it could be part of this new service. They don't really say, but this is a unique announcement because, again, it does come officially from Apple. And then there was finally, in terms of new shows and content, there was a little bit of follow-up on a show that we had already heard about, a series called Little America. And this confused me this week, so I wanted to cover it in, just in case it confused you, because I thought, you know, we've already covered the Little America thing. Apple, we knew Apple was working on this series. Well, it turns out what was going on is they actually had begun development of the series, but they hadn't really placed an order. So I'm guessing maybe that means they, kind of like the thing where they ordered a pilot, they took a look at it, had it produced, and said, yep, this is something that we want. So what's happening now is they have actually signed a deal. They are going to be doing that series. The series, if you don't remember, is inspired by some true stories that were featured in Epic Magazine over the years. And they say they plan to, quote, go beyond the headlines to look at the funny, romantic, heartfelt, inspiring, and surprising stories of immigrants in America. And the series is going to be produced and written by Lee Eisenberg, someone who's worked on The Office for 5 seasons. He's also, or I'm not sure if it's a he or she, actually. He or she is going to be serving as a showrunner, and also involved with the project are Kumail Nanjiani and Emily Gordon, who wrote and starred in The Big Sick, which is a great movie. If you haven't caught that, I encourage you to check that out. And also Alan Yang, who is from Master of None, along with several other folks. Those people are going to be serving as executive producers on Little America. And then, as I sort of alluded to a little bit earlier, we're getting some speculation on just exactly how Apple might actually release this content to us. We know at this point it's probably not going to be until sometime in 2019 before we see any of these shows. They're ramping up production. They're putting these things together, putting in the orders. Of course, they all have to be shot and filmed and produced and edited and all those sorts of things, and that takes time. But when they do get set to release it, Recode has made some informed speculation based on some help from, they say, quote, some industry observers about how Apple might do it. And they have kind of 3 theories. So I'm curious to get your take on this. I have my own take, and I'll share that with you. But let's first talk about the 3 ways where they might do this. Some say they might make some or all of their content available through the TV app on iOS and tvOS completely for free. So just, hey, here's content, buy an Apple TV, buy an iOS device, and you can watch this stuff. So that's one theory. It's just, hey, here's some content, and it's going to help them sell devices, I'm assuming. That's the theory there, is they'll sell more devices, hook more people in the Apple ecosystem, and they'll make their money that way. Another theory is that it would be combined with a, quote, very big subscription service that would roll together all of this new video stuff, this new original content, along with Apple Music, with iCloud services, and even AppleCare into kind of one big bundle that we would all subscribe to. I'm going to call it an Apple Prime plan, right? Just like Amazon Prime, everything kind of rolled into one. You pay one price per year, and you kind of get the whole ball of wax. And I like this idea of getting AppleCare as part of that bundle. Like, hey, if you buy in, we're just going to, you know, along with your AppleCare, you get all this other stuff, and you get coverage on your systems. I would assume they would then have to cover multiple devices. I'm not exactly sure how that would work, but I like this idea. And then the third option would be a standalone TV subscription service. They're saying one that would be priced below Netflix. And I would assume that this would include licensed content from other sources, much like Netflix does. So, you know, Netflix doesn't just have, they only have their original series. They have a bunch of content from a bunch of other places. Otherwise, it's going to be pretty thin, because Apple doesn't have that many shows in the pipeline right now. So I think it would be, have to be some sort of mix, and you would just buy another service. So you could get, you know, the Apple TV service or Apple Video service, whatever that might be. I have to tell you, my vote is definitely on an Apple Prime-like service. Maybe something that has a couple different tiers with different price points. Not too complex. I wouldn't want them to get too far out there, but maybe there's like a basic plan that comes in at one price, a pro plan, and a family plan, maybe with different levels of iCloud storage and those sorts of things, and you know, different coverages maybe on the AppleCare. I don't know how they would break it up, but that's the kind of thing that I would like to see. It'd be great if it was bundled into a one price thing. Now, some people might not like that, because you might like the idea of being able to get services more a la carte. I don't know if they'd be able to offer both, or if they would. I guess that would be a possibility, but my assumption, again, is the idea would be like an Amazon Prime, they would have an Apple Prime. And in case you're wondering, you know, is Apple really going to be able to pull this off? Can they catch up to the big guys, you know, Amazon and Netflix, right? Well, Gene Munster points out that while that might seem unsurmountable, remember, Netflix didn't have that many shows when they started out either. So Apple currently has about 17 shows in development. When Netflix launched their original content, they just had 13 in the first year. And Apple has coffers to actually spend money on this. While this year they're expected to spend about $1 billion, about $900 million on original shows, it's predicted that they're going to ramp that up to about $4.2 billion in 2020. Now, that's still pretty far behind Netflix, who I think is spending somewhere around $7-8 billion this year. But Apple's expected to be able to grow this pretty quickly, and they have the ability to do that. And they definitely want to grow their services business quickly. I mean, the whole idea behind this is to get more services revenue, the second most profitable area of Apple's business right now, remember, behind the iPhone, and growing faster than any other division, like 30-40% growth in services. So Apple is going to, you know, hit this pretty hard and heavy. And if you're wondering, well, why are they spending less? It's because Apple really is focused on the quality of the shows that they're picking up, and not quantity. Netflix is spending a lot of money. They currently have, this year, 1,000 original titles between TV shows and movies and things that they're doing. A lot of those are outside the U.S., but, you know, that's a lot of shows. Arguably, only a small percentage of those are really worth watching. I have a hard time finding stuff. I have a hard time even keeping up. I feel a little bit, frankly, I don't know how you feel, overwhelmed by the number of original series. I don't know what to watch on Netflix. And I think that's somewhat of a problem. I mean, it's great that you have all that choice, but I kind of like the idea of Apple really focusing on really good quality shows that a lot of people are going to want to watch that are going to have a broad appeal. And everything that we're hearing now seems to indicate that's exactly what they're doing. And don't forget, Apple has a serious branding advantage, and they also have the advantage of being able to bundle hardware and services together. And we've already seen how quickly that advantage has allowed them to grow Apple Music. Apple Music is expanding very, very quickly, adding subscribers very, very quickly. And that comes really from that tight integration of, you know, iOS, macOS, and, you know, Apple Music and the services that they're offering. So when they can take that and apply that to, you know, Apple Prime, that is going to be huge for them. So we're going to have to sit back and wait, but I think that's what is going to happen. And just throwing one last thing in for you to think about, I still maintain, and I talked about this a long time ago, I haven't brought this up in a while, I still maintain that Apple has a huge opportunity in terms of content. I was talking about, you know, do they need to license other content to kind of fill in the holes, because 17 shows isn't that much content. I still think they have this huge opportunity for gaining a lot of content from indies, independent creators, video podcasters, people just who just have stories to tell, and have the tools now between their Macs and their iPhones and all those things to tell those stories. I think Apple has a huge opportunity for creating a video distribution platform, a video store, almost like an app store, like they've done for books and apps. And independent creators could have a way to distribute their content to millions of devices, hundreds of millions of devices globally. It's like an instant marketplace for that, and they could offer it up on subscriptions if it's a TV show series, or they could do one-offs if it was a movie, and then Apple could get their 30% cut of the sales, so they could do the whole revenue split thing. Maybe they need to change the terms, I don't really know, but I think it's a huge opportunity for growth. Could they roll it into a subscription service and do some sort of rev share with content creators? I think that would be a little bit trickier. I kind of see this more as a side thing or an additive thing, but I don't know, maybe they can pull it off. But I think there's a huge thing that they could tap into, and they have a built-in audience and a built-in distribution network for it. They have the infrastructure. They just need to create the thing to let creators get their content into it. And I think it's still something that maybe they could ultimately do. And again, we're just going to have to wait and see. So I'm curious to get any of your thoughts on that. Shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. All right, real quickly, let's run through a couple of quick international stories. Apple is in preliminary talks to open its first retail store in Israel. They're supposedly looking into opening a store in the new Azrieli Towers in Tel Aviv. It's still early days and no exact deal is in place at the moment, but that does look like it might end up being the possible location for the first Apple retail store in Israel. HomePod is now available in Canada, France, and Germany. It went on sale this week. So if you happen to be in those regions and you've been jonesing for a HomePod, you can get it now in France and Germany. The HomePod is selling for 349 euros, and it is 449 in Canadian dollars. It also brings in the ability for you to get your news in those countries as well on the HomePod. So they're supporting various news services depending upon your region. So you can say, you know, hola Siri lady, read me the news, and it will get delivered for you. Somewhat related to that, Canadians also now apparently have access to live sports and news sections in the Apple TV app on their iPhone, iPad, or Apple TV. You can get your sports from CBC, DAZN, RDS Go, Sportsnet, and TSN Go, and you have news offerings from Bloomberg, CBC TV, Cheddar, CNN, and CTV News. Access to some of the content does require that you download the channel app and install it on your device, and some of it may require an extra fee, a subscription, or a verification from your TV service. And then lastly, in the international news, Apple Pay has launched in Poland. Customers can now add eligible Visa or a MasterCard credit or debit cards from one of 8 supported banks in the region. This comes 1 month after Apple launched Apple Pay in the Ukraine, and Apple is continuing to expand AppleCare, and so expect to hear about more countries coming on board in the future. But that's kind of it for some quick international news. Finally, in the news for this week, a little quick note on an update to iWork. Actually, kind of a cool, significant update to Apple's iWork applications came out this week. Apple updated Pages, Numbers, and Keynote for Mac and iOS. And the big thing here is all three of them now have gained the ability to record, edit, and playback audio. This includes the ability on iOS to import existing audio files into those applications with drag and drop. So expect a lot more audio in your keynotes if you're going to presentations. I don't know if that's a good or bad thing. I think depending upon how judiciously it's used, it probably could be a good thing. But also, I think a lot of these features look like they're targeted at maybe students, for the ability to take and record notes and things like that using something like Pages, versus maybe some other note application. Some other highlights include the fact that you can now select and scroll using the Apple Pencil in the applications. They also added mathematical equation support using LaTeX or MathML notation. So that's, again, great for students and researchers and people in the science and mathematics fields. You also now have the ability to edit or create new master slides in Keynote in iOS. That was something that in the past you'd only been able to do on the Mac. And then another kind of cool new feature in Keynote on iOS is the ability to export a presentation as a movie or a set of images. So if you haven't grabbed that, you can grab the new iWork updates through the Mac App Store or the App Store on your iOS device. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another one of my show sponsors, and that is Ulysses. Look, if you do any kind of writing on your Mac, your iPad, or your iPhone, you want to check out Ulysses. It is an awesome application for writing. It has all kinds of great organizational tools, the ability to do keywords, to set up writing goals. If you are a fan of Markdown, something I am a big convert to, as a matter of fact, I'm going to be doing a talk at this year's Mac Expo specifically on that. Ulysses is a perfect tool for writing and managing your Markdown documents. I love it because it allows me to write quickly and beautifully. It just looks really, really great. You know, I'm a fan of great looking apps. It displays all of my markup in just beautiful style, and they have awesome templates and themes that you can pick up. And then, like I said, with the organization, you've got filters and groups that makes it really easy to put projects together. I use it for all sorts of things like to-dos, presentations, documentation. I can keep all of that stuff separate. I can also search through it. I can easily add keywords to make that filtering and finding of documents even faster and easier. And recently, Ulysses just updated the app. They shipped out a brand new version with a bunch of awesome new updates and enhancements. And of course, because it's all about me and the features that I like, I'm a developer. They added great support for their code blocks. You can actually now specify up to 40 different programming languages, and it will do syntax highlighting for you, both in the editor and when you export it. They also added support for GitHub-flavored Markdown. In the goals section, you also can now set up daily writing goals based on characters or words, and you get a little circular symbol that will help you visualize your progress, and it resets every day. So if you want to make sure you're writing a certain amount on your project every day, that's going to really, really help you, and you can monitor the progress of that over time and even export that data to a CSV file. And finally, you can now add custom colors to your keywords. That makes them easier to spot in your library. There's just a bunch of great new features in there. And in addition to all of that, of course, they have full iCloud syncing, so you could use it on all your devices, have everything synced across. You've got nested groups. You've got the distracted-free writing mode, and that is one that's really, really great for writers. Ulysses, it really is, in my opinion, the best app for writers on your Mac or your iOS device. You can get a monthly subscription for just $4.99. A yearly subscription is going to run you $39.99. They have discounts for students, $10.99 for a six-month subscription. And if you want to try it out, there is a special offer for MacCast listeners right now. You can use Ulysses for free for 3 months by going to ulyssesapp.com. ulysses.com/MacCast. That's ulysses.com/MacCast. You can also download it for free on the Mac App Store, but use that link because you're going to get a longer trial. Out of the box through the Mac App Store, you get a 14-day trial, which is still great, but you know, you take the 3 months, use that, try it out. I really encourage you to do it. And if you're a Set App customer, guess what? You already have Ulysses. Just download it, install it. Install it right now if you're on Set App. There's no reason not to have this on your Mac. You really should have it. You can get more information on the Ulysses website, ulyssesapp.com/MacCast. Please support them because they support the show. And a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. All right. I heard from all of you. Believe me, I heard from all of you. Yeah, I messed up. When I mess up, you guys always have my back, and I'm not upset about it at all. It's great. It's one of the things I love about our community, and luckily this time it wasn't a really big mess up. Last week I told you about Notability, a great note-taking app for your iPad. I like it for handwritten notes. That's mainly what I use it for. And I told you about all the great features, and I said it didn't have a Mac version. You think I even alluded that maybe with the new features of iOS app porting that we saw at Worldwide Developer Conference that maybe they would port it to the Mac. Well, guess what? It's already on the Mac. I should have searched the Mac App Store. I didn't. I went to the developer's website, and in my own defense, if you go to the website, it's not really obvious that they have a Mac version. If you scroll all the way down to the bottom, you do see a Mac with a screenshot, and down in the lower, I think, right-hand corner, there is the Mac App Store button. But prominently at the top of the website is the iOS app button. So it's the same price for the Mac version as it is for the iOS version, $9.99 US. But you can get Notability for your Mac. And many of you wrote in to tell me how much you love Notability on the Mac. So it's got a great endorsement from the Mac community. So if you're looking for a note-taking app and you're evaluating different ones, that is one to look into. And thanks to everybody who wrote in to make sure that I didn't miss that. I really do appreciate it. Another thing I talked about on the last episode of the MacCast was the fact that I have kind of come around and resolved myself to what in days past I called the new app order. The fact that more and more apps are going to be moving to the subscription model as a way to gain recurring revenue and kind of deal with the fact, especially on iOS, that they don't have the ability to sell app upgrades, discounted upgrades to customers. And I said, you know, I actually kind of like it, especially when it turns out, you know, what I might spend in a given year is the same amount that I would normally spend on that app when I buy it outright. And then because I typically, if it's an app that I love and I really use, new version comes out, there's not even any hesitation. I'm just always buying it anyway. So I'm paying that upgrade price. So, you know, the ability to give the developer money every month, know that they've got a more sustainable stable revenue coming in, and they can roll out new features whenever they want. I think there is some advantages to the subscription model. And I asked for your opinion on it, and Jill wrote in to share some of her thoughts on specifically why she's not a big fan of app subscriptions. And as she points out, what happens when I can't afford the subscription anymore, right? If you don't pay for the subscription app, you lose access to the app. And especially if that app uses proprietary formats, you may lose access to the content that you have in those applications. And this could be a big problem if it's a writing app or a note-taking app or something like that, and there's not an easy way to get that content out. Or, you know, maybe it's some sort of database-driven app, and it has stuff that's really in a unique format for that application. You know, how do you get that stuff out? Can you save it to a PDF? Can you export it in some way? I know with some subscription apps, when you stop paying, you don't get fully locked out, but maybe they give you the ability to open and still read documents. You just can't create new ones. But, you know, as she points out, and rightfully so, if you buy the app outright, as long as that app will still run on the hardware that you have, there's no reason you can't keep using it. You don't have to upgrade, and you don't have to worry about it. It gives you a little bit more longevity on your app, and I get that. That is totally an advantage of buying the app outright. You're sort of not locked into this perpetual subscription for forever, especially if you fall on rough times and maybe you just have to start cutting back. Now, luckily, in this day and age, I think there's a lot of, you know, free or cheaper or ad-supported alternatives. It may not be the perfect solution, but sometimes you might just have to switch to a different app. And I definitely think if you're looking at a subscription-based app versus a paid-for app, a consideration that you have is, hey, how easy is it for me to get my information and my stuff out of this? You know, many apps will read or even edit other formats, for example, you know, Photoshop files, Word documents. There's a lot of applications that aren't Photoshop or Word that can bring in those formats. So you feel a little bit safer of maybe getting a Creative Cloud subscription or an Office 365 subscription, knowing that you're not going to be totally locked out of your documents, right? You can use pages or numbers, but other applications may or may not have that ability. So I really do think it becomes important in the age of subscription apps to look at data portability and factor that in when you're deciding to purchase a subscription. You know, does it have a standardized format? Can I get it out in some way? Another thing to remember is, at least at an OS level, we do have the print to PDF option. So if it is a document-based app, at least you can maybe create a readable version of that before you cancel your subscription. You might, again, not be able to get in and edit it, that is a way you could possibly handle that. And I mentioned to Jill that, you know, my change in how I think about the subscription model doesn't mean that I am 100% a fan of the subscription model in every case. It's really just that I've resolved myself to the fact that this is the future for a lot of apps, and I'm not fighting it as much anymore. And by not fighting it, I'm actually a little bit happier with some of the apps that I'm using that are apps that I really love and depend on and that have gone to subscription. I'm not so angry when the developer comes back and says, hey, yeah, we're moving to the subscription model. I think it has a lot of advantages, you know, again, being the biggest, in my opinion, being that it provides a more continuous and stable income for the developer, which I think incentivizes the developer to put in new features and keep working on the app and all those sorts of things. So at least if I'm still paying, the app will still be around and getting updates and features and stuff like that. But this, all of this, and again, Jill's points are very, very valid. All of this does play into a larger discussion that I think we've had on the MacCast about not just single app, you know, data storage and portability, but data storage and portability across the board for your Mac. A conversation that we have a lot here on the MacCast is about backups and archives and keeping your data safe. I have to tell you, still to this day, I will get emails from someone or an email from someone asking about old AppleWorks files. They'll say, hey, I have this college paper, this dissertation I wrote, and it's in AppleWorks. How can I get that file? I'd like to access it or read it again. I want to share it with someone. And a lot of times it's like, well, do you have access to a really old Mac and a copy of AppleWorks? Because outside of that, I'm not sure I can help you. You know, you're going to have to get it into that format. And I think there are still some services and tools online you can find. You can email me in, but email me if you know some of those. But I do know that those exist. But it's not, point is, it's not easy, right? And so even without subscriptions, there may come a day when that old Mac that you have that's running that purchased application either breaks down or stops working, or the OS won't install anymore. You know, like, something is eventually going to happen. So again, I think thinking about data portability, how do I get this into a format that's maybe a more standardized format, text or PDF, that I know I can take it and I'm going to be able to get it into some other place. And not only that, but for stuff that you're archiving, format shifting, meaning, do you have stuff on a USB thumb drive and it's a USB-A port? What happens when that goes away? You know, we have dongles and adapters, but will that last for forever? Probably not. How many of us still have stuff on floppies, you know, 3.5-inch, 5.25-inch floppies or zip disks? That came up recently in a conversation, right? You probably have some of those floating around. Do you have a zip drive that you can actually pop that in and read that data off of? More likely not. I have VHSs and I don't have a VHS player. What do I do about that stuff? Another one I'm going to get in trouble for is I have mini DV tapes with videos of my kids growing up on them. I don't know that I have a video player to play those in. I've got to get them off to a service, and I know this exists, to get them converted to digital. But that's format shifting, right? I need to move them to digital, put them onto hard drives, and at some point I'm going to have to take them off hard drives and, I don't know, put them on, you know, dilithium crystals or, you know, some sort of crystal storage or whatever the next thing is, right? So the stuff we want to save, we do have to, you know, think about format shifting, think about data portability and all of these things, right? Along with everything else, we have to think about backup and all that other stuff. But it's important, especially for the stuff that we really care about. And anytime we have these conversations related to this kind of stuff, it gets me thinking about it. So I want to get you thinking about it too, because I just hate getting the emails where I have to tell somebody, you know, I don't think you're getting that data back. That's really frustrating. So let's not have those. All right. Let's think about this stuff. On the last show, we also discussed the deprecation of OpenGL and OpenCL in Mac OS High Sierra. And if, in case you don't understand those acronyms or know what those mean, those are, you know, 3D and GPU processing stuff, mostly related to gaming or high-end video applications or 3D modeling applications, things like that. But it's of a big concern to folks in the gaming community. And we talked about some of the ramifications for that. The biggest one being that there's a lot of games, especially indie games and titles, that maybe don't use Apple's Metal 2 proprietary format or Metal. They use these older open technologies for their 3D graphics and their rendering and their processing on GPUs and stuff like that. That stuff is going away in High Sierra, and Apple is saying, hey, you need to convert over to Metal and Metal 2, the proprietary stuff. So we were having a conversation. Well, what does that actually mean for gamers? Is it a big deal? David wrote in to say that, you know, with the service Steam, gaming service Steam, coming to the Mac, he's seen more and more developers, indie developers included, producing titles, Mac OS titles, in games for Steam. And that for him is a good thing. He's a gamer. He really likes that. And it's actually, he said, caused him to have to use Bootcamp less, because another way gamers, specifically Mac gamers, have gotten around some of the limitations is, hey, we've got Bootcamp. We can boot into Windows. It will work with most of the hardware with a little bit of fiddling, but generally that was a way around it. And since he's now getting more native games through Steam that actually run on Mac OS, he's having to boot less and less into that. And we've kind of had this resurgence in this movement of more developers targeting the Mac. And he has concerns that anything that Apple might do to upset those developers, like deprecating OpenGL and OpenCL support, could reduce the number of developers who are willing to port their stuff to the Mac, because in some cases it's going to make it harder. The big advantage of OpenGL and OpenCL is you can work in that and then target both the Windows platform and the Mac platform. With going to native stuff on both sides, you've got to do a little bit more work. It's more work to be put in. And if you're an indie developer, you don't have a giant gaming budget, that might not be something you're willing to do, especially to support the Mac market, which is much smaller in terms of games than the PC market. So he has that concern that, you know, if you're going to make it harder, then they're going to go back to their old ways. They're going to say, you know, we're really just going to put this out on PC because it's too much hassle to bring it over to the Mac. So, you know, that is, I think, a very valid concern. And his concern is it may erode some of the progress that's been made into the Mac gaming market. So I don't know. What are your thoughts on that? I kind of agree with David. It could hurt that. But, you know, ultimately, I think, too, gamers really care about the experience, right? I know that, like, frame rates and all those sorts of things are of a pretty big importance to them. Somewhat related to this, and I'll have a link to this in the show notes at maccast.com, Apple Insider wrote a great piece this week with their opinions on the state of Mac gaming and the Mac gaming landscape, and they called it kind of grim, or dire, I think was the word that they used in the article. And what they were doing was pointing out the huge disparity between Mac gaming and iOS gaming. And I think I talked about this a little bit last week as well. You know, iOS for games is the king. It's on top. I mean, it is a huge gaming platform. Major game developers target iOS, but it's also a very different style of game. And Macs, for those same developers, are kind of chump change. There aren't a lot of guys playing on that. They're targeting consoles. They're targeting PC. And then Mac is still, in a lot of ways, somewhat an afterthought. But as David pointed out, that philosophy had been sort of changing a little bit. We'd been moving more in a positive direction. But now it might be moving back the other way. And the piece points out, too, that, you know, a big challenge for game developers targeting the Mac and just gamers on the Mac is that Apple doesn't, you know, really target the highest end GPUs, graphics processors, right? They do the integrated GPU thing on a lot of their models. And so that makes it even more challenging. But now we have eGPU support. And they say that's great, but you know what? That's pretty costly. It's not easy for a lot of people to get into that. Now, they brought this up, and I kind of don't buy that as something that would scare off a lot of gamers, because most of the gamers, especially PC gamers that I know, they spend thousands and thousands of dollars on their rigs. They're not afraid to plunk in money to get high-end GPUs and GPU boxes and all this extra gear and equipment to make their games run faster. So I'm not really buying that is going to be a problem, the cost of that solution. Yes, it's probably going to cost a little bit more than building your own PC, but you know, Mac people are a little bit crazy too, and we don't mind spending a little bit of extra money to get the solution that we like and we want. They do point out, though, that the eGPUs still don't have support for NVIDIA cards, so they're limited to ATI cards on the Mac, and that's a little bit of a problem. I would agree with that. And there is no eGPU support in boot camp, at least not without doing some pretty serious hacks, according to the article. And that's another problem, because again, as we pointed out earlier, not every title that gamers want to play is necessarily available natively for the Mac. And so a lot of folks like to boot up into boot camp on their Macs to kind of get past that restriction. We also now have the ability to use an HTC Vive on macOS. They added that last year with the eGPU, so that helps a lot because virtual reality gaming is kind of becoming a big thing in the gaming space. And of course, Steam, as we mentioned earlier, is awesome. But as David mentioned, and as the Apple Insider piece points out, it's pretty shallow when it comes to Mac titles. And I've gone in there, I have to admit, to look for things. I bought Firewatch, which is a great game for the Mac, through Steam. But you go in there and you see all these great titles and you start shopping around and you realize that a very small percentage of them are actually available to play on the Mac. And Steam Link, which is this thing that will be great once it gets approved on the App Store, it will still only run Mac-based games. So what Steam Link does is it allows you to use your iOS device or your Apple TV to play a game over the network that actually uses the processors and the GPU on your Mac, and then just kind of almost in an AirPlay-style thing puts it up on your Apple TV and allows you to use, say, like a Bluetooth controller to actually interact with and play with the game on the Apple TV. So it's kind of like having a console in your house, but the processor is actually your computer. And they were Steam was rejected, I think, last week. The app was rejected because it had in-app purchases and it was violating the App Store rules for in-app purchases. So Apple's been working with Steam. They've resubmitted it without that functionality in there. A note saying that purchases of games are going to need to be made on a Mac or PC, and it probably will be approved soon, maybe by the time you hear this episode. So that is another option. But, you know, everything is still kind of this little bit, and this is sort of what the Apple Insider piece is pointing out, is still this little janky kind of workaround, especially on the Mac. So, you know, Mac gaming, it's never been a big thing. It's gotten better. It's now maybe in flux. It sounds like it's a little bit still kind of tough for hardcore Mac gamers out there. So I'm still curious to get a lot more of your feedback on this. That's why I'm continuing the conversation in this episode. So if you have something to say, send me an email, maccast@gmail.com. Another thing that came up this week, somewhat, I think, semi-related to this, is the relatively sad state of current Mac hardware. And what I mean by current Mac hardware is I mean updated Mac hardware. Over at Rogue Amoeba, there's a blog post on the sad state of Macintosh hardware. Great blog post on this. Again, I'll have a link in the show notes at maccast.com. But they pointed out the list. What was happening was Rogue Amoeba is wanting to test out some of the new features in Mac OS Mojave with their software, and they needed some newer machines. They wanted some newer hardware to test it out on. But when they went to the Mac App Store, and when they looked at the Mac rumors list on, you know, how old or how long it's been since the last updates of the Mac models, because they didn't want to buy old hardware if new updates might be coming soon, they discovered, you know what? There's only one machine currently in Apple's entire lineup that's been updated within the last 365 days, and that would be the new iMac Pro. Other than that, the iMac, the MacBooks, the MacBook Pros, all of those are over 379 days old. It's been 379 days, more than a year, since we've seen an update, any kind of update to those models. And again, update is being generous, because some of these models have only had minor speed bumps and not any real huge changes under the hood. Things get even worse, of course, for the Mac Pro. 441 days since we saw that update. And again, that's being very generous, because in all honesty, that machine has not been updated since 2013 and will not be updated, as we know, until at least 2019. Could be longer if Apple doesn't have something ready, but we do expect it sometime in 2019. Apple's promising it. It's going to be a modular system. It's going to be awesome whenever we get it. And the poor old Mac Mini. Yeah, if you're a Mac Mini fan, it is super grim. 1,343 days since the Mac Mini has seen an update. Yep, that was back in, 2014 was when Apple updated that. So here's the debate being laid out in the article. Rather than attempting to wow the world, and this is a quote, rather than attempting to wow the world with innovative new designs like the failed Mac Pro, Apple could and should simply provide updates and speed bumps to its entire lineup on a much more frequent basis. And so I'm bringing this up because I'm curious to get your thoughts on that. I'm honestly not so sure that it absolutely is necessary. As bleak as these numbers seem, right? It seems like, wow, Apple hasn't updated a machine in over a year. That seems bad in when we think about technology, because we always think technology, you know, goes so quick. It needs to be updated so quickly. And we get frustrated over the lack of new models. I want to buy something new. But I have to step back and say, well, what are we really chasing here? And the reason I'm saying this is, yes, you know, when it comes time to buy a new machine, you want to buy the newest thing available, and you're hoping that your timing works out, that I want to upgrade my Mac. Oh, there's a brand new model out. Let me get that thing, because then I have the latest and greatest, and it's going to give me the longest life, the longest longevity. But the reality is that a lot of the older hardware is still really, really good, even by today's standards. And you're able to keep machines much, much longer. And I think this is something that Apple is wrestling with, right? Is, yeah, we could put out a slight minor update to our processor every 3 months, 6 months, like they do in the PC market. But what are we really chasing here? You know, does another minor bump in clock speed really, at the end of the day, mean much in terms of performance? And I think we're moving to this, you know, longer cycle where we're going to get into a rhythm, right? Eventually, we're all going to be on the same release cycle. We're going to recognize that Apple's putting out new Macs every 12 months, you know, every 12 months to 18 months. I'm guessing more on like an 18-month cycle is what we're going to see this falling into. And we're just going to have to start to fall in line. If you're the type of person who wants to have the latest and greatest, you're just going to know, all right, September. Every September, Apple's going to release their new models. That's when I'm going to upgrade. 3 years from the time I buy that one, or 2 years, or whatever your upgrade cycle for your machine is, that's what you're going to fall into. And I know that doesn't work for everyone, and it doesn't work if you need to buy a new machine now and all that stuff. But, you know, the same sort of rules that I've always used are going to be true. And that is, if you absolutely need a machine, you need to replace a machine, you need a machine now, buy the best possible machine with all of the RAM, all the storage, all of the bells and whistles that you can possibly afford at that moment, use it and be happy, right? Don't get so bogged down in the minutiae that you drive yourself crazy. And I think a lot of us do this, right? Is, oh, it doesn't have the latest Intel, insert name of city or whatever they use for their naming convention here, right? It's not the latest lake processor in there. That lake processor is 1 year old or 2 years old. Don't get bogged down in that. Is it going to do the thing that you need to do? Is it going to be better than the machine that you have now? And will you be happy when you're using it? That is the thing you need to decide. And buy the best machine you can buy at the moment. And the flip side of that is also true, though, too. If you can wait, just wait for that cycle to happen. Apple will update their machines eventually. And if you can hang on for another 3 months, 9 months, 6 months, even maybe another year, just do that. Get by with your existing machine and then wait when Apple comes out with a new model. Then there's your time to buy. And then you have the latest and greatest thing. And you can always have the latest and greatest thing if you keep with that philosophy. Now, I know this is probably controversial. There's probably some of you yelling at your device right now, telling me how wrong I am. I don't want you to yell at your device, though. I want you to actually record a comment, send an email, let me know, because I want to hear from the community. And I've been hearing less from you guys these past few episodes. I'm hoping you're still out there. I think you're still out there, but I'm not getting as much feedback as I have been. So let's keep the conversation going. Let me know what you think about this, the state of Mac gaming, and also just the state of Apple and Mac hardware. Is it getting grim out there? Or is that just a perception? I don't really know. I have a feeling it's just more of a perception and a thought, and we just need to change our thinking and attitude a little bit about how this stuff is going to work moving forward. Because frankly, I don't think computer technology, CPUs and GPUs are moving as fast. You know, we're not seeing the massive leaps in performance. You're talking about minor bumps in performance. If you're talking about just a couple megahertz here or there, it's kind of bigger on the GPU side. And maybe that's a bigger conversation to have around this. But again, shoot me some feedback, maccast@gmail.com. All right, last thing that we have to get into today is a little help for listener Andrew. Here is the problem that he is having, and I know he's not alone in this one. I know there's other people out there that have had either this issue or one very similar. So let's try to help him out here. Here's Andrew.
Hi, Adam. This is Andrew from Sheffield in the north of England. I've got a bit of an issue with Google always wanting my password day in, day out for my Google Calendar. I have it hooked up to iCal in OS 10 High Sierra, but every day at about this time, and it's currently 9:07 on a Thursday morning, I get a notification on my desktop, Google password required, enter your password for this account in internet accounts. Now, obviously, I do that every day and I authenticate it using the Google app on my phone, but it happens every single day. So Google seems to be quite needy for that password for some reason, and I'm not quite sure why. I've taken off the account, uninstalled that account from OS X and my iDevice and everywhere else, to reinstall it and reauthenticate, but yet this still keeps happening. So basically help. Hope you can explain it and help me out. Thanks a lot.
Hey, Andrew, we're going to try, although I don't know if anybody really can explain all of the mysteries that are Google, right? I don't know if we know how all of these things work. I guess it could be a problem on the Mac side as well, right? Some sort of authentication thing is happening. One thing I just thought of, actually, as I was listening to that piece, I don't even have it in my notes, is I wonder if there is like attempts on the web interface on Google to access your account, if maybe you get sort of a lockout or it gets it to a point where it wants you to kind of re-authenticate. I don't think there is, but that was just something I was thinking about. It sounds like you already did a lot of the obvious things that most of us would do, going into system preferences, into internet accounts, removing the account and re-adding it. You said you already did that. I did read one thing when I was kind of researching this that said to make sure that you were make sure that the calendar application and the mail application were fully quit when you were actually doing this. So I don't know if you did that or paid attention if that was going on, but making sure the application was not open when you were removing those accounts. And I don't think it would make a difference, but in calendar, I know in mail, right, you can access the accounts kind of in two different ways. I can't remember if they fixed it in High Sierra where it actually automatically defaults you back to the system preferences internet accounts. I think it does. They may have already even done that in Sierra and even further back. I don't know. But there used to be this thing where you could access the accounts from either area, maybe trying to remove it inside the calendar versus inside. I don't think you can inside the calendar, but if it was a problem with mail, maybe removing it inside of mail versus inside of internet accounts, maybe that would make a difference. I don't know. I'm kind of grasping at straws here, as you might be hearing, because I really don't know that I have a good answer for you. The other thing that I thought of, though, was it does sound like you're using two-factor authentication, because you mentioned using your Google app to do the authentication. So it shouldn't be necessary to do this, because the internet accounts fully supports two-factor authentication, and it may even not allow you to do this, but maybe try generating and using an app-specific password inside the settings for calendar in the internet accounts. Maybe that would make a difference, but again, I don't think it would, because I think the way Google accounts work, right, is you do the Google login and then it gives you access to everything. It's not really app specific. I know I have to use an app specific password for, say, like Fantastical for my Google stuff. So you might try that if you can. I don't know if it'll let you do that, but it was just another thing that I could think of that maybe you could try, because maybe it's running into that problem. I think there was also some sort of setting in the Google thing where you can like make the password checking less secure, but I don't think you'd really want to do that, which is why I didn't add it to my show notes, but I did read about that when I was doing my research too. There was some sort of setting in GCal that you could tweak, and you could say, you know, don't use a secure password checking as you normally would. But I wouldn't advise that. The only last thing that I could think of, and then we'll throw it out to the community, is you might, after you remove the account, or maybe even before, you might check for any extra or maybe older password entries or authentications that might be in your keychain. So going into applications, utilities, and into keychain access, and then searching for Google. I did notice on my Mac there were a number of entries for the Google accounts, and I have multiple Google accounts, so there were multiples of these. But there is something called an OAuth token NoSync, an OAuth token, an OAuth expiry date, and an OAuth refresh token. And so maybe something's getting kerfuffled and you have maybe some older versions of those or an older entry related to those that isn't getting purged out when you remove the internet account. And so maybe just clearing those out manually. Again, be careful with this, because you don't want to remove the wrong tokens, but maybe go in there and remove those four entries that match your account. You can click on them and you can get some informational details. I think you might have to click on the info button inside Keychain Access, but you can check and find the ones related to the account that's giving you the problem, and maybe just manually delete those from your keychain. And then when you go back to re-add the account, it should recreate them. I thought there is an expiration column, like when these tokens get set, they do or can be set to expire, but I did notice for mine the expire column was blank. So I'm assuming when you add them to your internet account, they're not set to expire. I assume yours are like that too, but you might look, maybe there's, for some weird reason, an expiration that's a 24-hour expiration and those things aren't lasting. Again, I'm just throwing out ideas because I really don't have a hard answer for you. I did some research on this. I couldn't find a definitive solution. So there's some ideas that you can try. I'm also going to throw it out to you in the community. Can we help Andrew out here? Have you run into this problem? Have you been able to solve it on your Mac? I'm still not running macOS High Sierra, so I don't know if this is specifically a High Sierra issue. I don't think it is, because again, I've run into similar issues to this more often than not, though, with iCloud accounts, not Google accounts in my experience, but I do know people run into this occasionally. And so send us your tips, your tricks, your possible solutions, maccast@gmail.com, and Andrew Andrew, good luck. Hopefully, maybe one of the things that I mentioned triggers something that might work for you. Or if not, then on the next episode of the MacCast, maybe someone in the community will have your answer. So stay tuned. But with that, that is going to do it for the show for this week. Before I leave you, a couple quick housekeeping things to get into. Quick reminder, MacStock 2018 is coming up very, very quickly here in July. If you want to go to the conference, MacStockConferenceAndExpo.com. Make sure you check out the speaker list. I am going to be speaking there. I'm going to be doing a session on all about Markdown and how I use Markdown. The show theme this year is all about productivity. So there's a bunch of productivity talks from a who's who of great people from the Mac and Apple community. Wally Cherwinski, myself, you've got David Ginsberg, Kelly Gaumont, Gene McDonald, from Chuck Joyner, Guy Searle, Tim Robertson, Allison Sheridan, Mike Schmidt, and Brett Terpstra. I mean, this is a great deal, a great value, a great weekend. It is super fun. If you're going to be anywhere near the area in July, and the dates are, and I always screw this up, I don't bring it up in front of me, and my internet is going, so July 21st through the 22nd in Woodstock, Illinois. If you're going to be anywhere near there, I encourage you to attend. I'd love to see you there. You can actually still get the early bird pricing on the full weekend pass, so you can get a discount if you use the code MACCAST. I think it's something like $70 off total on that 2-day ticket. You do have to get the 2-day ticket. Go there, MacStockConferenceAndExpo.com, and use the code MACCAST, and I hope to see you there in just a couple weeks. And then if you are a Patreon supporter, I sent out some emails this week. I also put a post up on Patreon, but I am getting very, very close to having the membership cards for the people who supported at the $5 and $10 levels. That's the Classic and the Pro levels. If you want to see what the card design looks like, I posted a mock-up of that on the website. I think they look great. I'm getting a lot of great feedback from you. You should have received an email from me just saying double check the shipping address that is on your account. And the way you have to do it, if you log into your Patreon, go into the menu by clicking on the three little lines and then go to My Rewards and then find the MacCast, and you should see a little link there that says shipping address and reward level, and you can change and double check the information there. So just verify that the correct shipping address is there for you. And if you are on the older MacCast membership program and you didn't transition over yet, you also would have gotten an email from me. If you received an email from me, same sort of thing. Just make sure that I have your current mailing address, and those are probably going to mail out hopefully within the next 30 days. They're in production right now. It takes about 3 weeks to produce them. And we're doing I should mention, they are these gorgeous metal business cards. They're actually from the same company that produces the metal business cards for Woz. So it's a metal membership card. It's going to have laser etching and cutouts, and it's super, super cool. I think you guys are really going to like it. I'm very excited about them. So those are available to Patreons who support, again, at the $5 and $10 levels. But if you want to help support the MacCast, keep this thing going, help me cover a lot of the costs that I have in terms of equipment and server costs and all the yearly costs, being able to go to these great events like MacStock and meet up with you guys in the real world. I want to be doing a lot more of that. Of course, that takes cash and funding and those sorts of things. You got to pay for hotels and plane tickets, which are not cheap. If you want to help support with that, become a Patreon supporter. You can do it at whatever level you want. We have lots of options. There's a bunch of different rewards. You can read all about those at patreon.com/MacCast. And even if you can't do that, if you can just tell people about the show, tell them to subscribe. I know Google just updated their app. They're going to have podcasts now in a native app on Android. So get your Android friends over, get them converted over to Mac, get them listening to the MacCast. Just tell somebody about it, and then just follow me on social media, tweeting, you know, just generally being part of the Mac community, MacCast community, is a great way to support the show too. And I appreciate any way you want to support the show, whether it's the Patreon or just sending in emails or making a comment or sending me a message on Twitter, it's all totally awesome. And I love you guys. You are, I've said it before and I'll say it again, you are the best community in all of Apple fandom, all of Mac fandom, whatever you want to call it, the Apple sphere, the Mac sphere. You guys totally rock. So thank you for that. Before I get out of here, I do want to take a quick moment and thank somebody else who's awesome, and that's our show sponsor, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, and Text Expander for your iOS devices. You can get more information and details on all of their great applications by visiting smilesoftware.com/podcast, and they've been a huge supporter of the MacCast for a very long time, so please go support them, buy their products. They are awesome. The entire team over there, really awesome people and great members of the community. So there's that. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. Finally, as always, I love hearing from you. You are so much a part of this community. Send me your emails, your audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. Also call in on the listener hotline, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. You can leave voicemail there. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And if you want to follow me on social media, you'll find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can also check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast, or check out the Google Plus community. That's at google.com/PlusMacCast. But that'll do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.